Good morning, everyone. Monday, May 4th, the start of another week of war. And here are reports by our staff reporters at home and overseas. First, for news from Britain, we switch direct to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. British planes, in spite of bad flying weather over the continent, bombed Hamburg, Germany's second largest city, last night. About 30 German bombers made a sharp one-hour raid on the English city of Exeter. This is one of the Baedeker cities that the Germans raided last week. Considerable damage is reported, and there are a number of casualties. 7 German raiders were shot down, 5 over England, and 2 over their bases in northern France. A one-armed RAF pilot, squadron leader McLachlan, sent both the last 2 down in flames. Admiral Stark, the new commander-in-chief of American naval forces in European waters, has just been talking to something like 150 press, radio, and newsreel men in London. The fact that he chose today for his first full-dress press conference had more than usual significance, because it was just 25 years ago today that the first American destroyers arrived in Queenstown, Ireland, in the last war. Mr. A.V. Alexander, First Lord of the Admiralty, sent a message read by a British admiral to Admiral Stark. The First Lord welcomed Admiral Stark and said he hoped both our countries will learn that our cooperation shouldn't be confined to periods of war, but should be exercised at all times in keeping free the sea lanes of the world for the use of all in pursuit of their lawful occasions. Admiral Stark stood up and talked with his hands in his coat pockets. His quiet voice gave his listeners an impression of assurance. He said he hoped that he won't go back to America until the war's over, but the shorter the time, he said, the happier we'll be. The American commander-in-chief recalled some of his experiences of the last war and quoted Admiral Sims' phrase that if we lick the subs, the Huns are licked. Admiral Stark spoke of the present submarine campaign as one of the vital issues. He noted that neither Britain nor America seemed to have been able to prepare for war in peacetime, and he said, had either of us spent in peacetime a fraction of what we're spending today for war, the war wouldn't have happened. The American commander assured his British listeners that American war effort is moving at what he called accelerated pace. He said American merchant shipbuilding hit the 2-a-day speed last month. And he said, even with his running start, we'll stop Hitler and beat him. Admiral Stark referred to the phrase, defense won't win the war, declaring, you can't win a war by parrying blows any more than you can in a prize ring. He asserted that the United Nations must be prepared to take calculated risks, perhaps involving heavy losses. But he warned that mere recklessness will only end in defeat. We can hardly wait for the time, he went on, when we'll have the strength to take the offensive and keep going. A British reporter asked the admiral whether he favored a second front in 1942. Admiral Stark said, I'm in favor of any second or third or fourth front or offensive, whenever, wherever, and as soon as we can take it. But where and when, I couldn't forecast. He disclosed that the British and American navies are pooling everything they have. There is not one thing we know or think we know or are planning that we're not pooling, he explained. He said he thought the British were doing the same. The admiral said, I feel here in Britain as I do when I cross the Canadian border, that I'm in another part of home. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now a report from the heart of the Soviet Union. Robert Magadov has just returned to Moscow from Kuibyshev and is waiting to report on developments on the important Russian fighting front. Here is Magadov from Moscow. Ladies and gentlemen, we regret that reception will not permit us to attempt this broadcast from Moscow, and we continue now with news from our New York newsroom. Moscow, the Soviet Information Bureau announces that another 2,000 Nazi officers and men have been killed on the Leningrad front. This is the second successive announcement of heavy German losses on the siege lines around that northern city. Yesterday, a communique said 1,500 Germans had been slain there. Indications point to Russian plans for their own spring offensive. But the official word is that no significant land changes have occurred during the past 24 hours. One Red Army unit on an undesignated sector is said to have driven the Germans from important communications lines. The communist newspaper Pravda, in predicting the Soviet offensive as soon as the spring floods subside, says the Red Army will beat the German fascist bandits even harder in the spring and summer than they did in the winter. Bogota, the Republic of Colombia, is still tabulating returns in its presidential election. The returns are unofficial and incomplete, but so far, former President Alfonso López is leading Carlos Aranjo Vélez by better than 2-1. And now, for a word of developments in the Pacific Theater of War, we take you to the newsroom in San Francisco.
Zarajansku Ukrainu, meaning for Soviet Ukraine, more than 15 million copies of which have been published and distributed in the German-occupied regions of the Ukraine. The paper is brought there by plane and is scattered over populated points. Sometimes it is delivered to guerrilla headquarters, and they see to it that the paper giving information of the Soviet advance falls into the hands of the Ukrainians. A cabinet decree signed by Premier Stalin promoted 77 Red Army officers to rank of general. The list includes the name of Mikhail Gromov, hero of the Soviet Union, famous for his non-stop flight in 1937 from Moscow to the United States over the North Pole. Goodbye from Moscow.
And now from San Francisco, we take you to the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Sydney Albright calling from Australia. The time is 10:06 on Monday evening. Word was received today of a Japanese force which is pushing southward from Salamoa, 175 miles north of Port Moresby. The invaders are reported to have reached a point 15 miles below Salamoa. It is also reported that the Japanese who advanced up the Markham Valley as far as Nadsab on Saturday have retreated to Leh. The Japanese had reached Nadsab a month ago, but were forced to retreat because of heavy floods. Military officials suggest that this enemy move was merely to test the defenders' strength because of the necessity for dispersing supplies and finding new aerodromes, following the continued battering by Allied aircraft recently. The Japanese may also plan to encircle the vital aerodromes at Wong, Bulwa, and Bololo, which would be an important springboard for any large-scale offensive against Moresby. The capture of Wall would also enable them to link up with the forces from Salamoa and place them at a considerable advantage. It is over 70 miles from Wall to Salamoa, and the route traverses the jungle tracks and a mountain range between 6 and 7,000 feet high. The Allied communique, which was issued this afternoon, refers to a successful attack on enemy shipping at Raval and severe damage inflicted on an enemy aircraft in a running duel with two Allied reconnaissance planes. The communique states that at Port Moresby, an aerodrome was raided yesterday by 12 enemy bombers and an escort of 8 Zeros. Allied fighters intercepted, brilliantly destroying 3 bombers and 1 fighter. Our losses were slight. New Britain, Rabaul. Our Air Force attacked enemy shipping in the harbor on Saturday night, obtaining direct hits on 1 transport. Solomons, Bougainville. 2 Allied bombers on reconnaissance on Sunday engaged a 4-engine flying boat in a 35-minute running duel. The enemy aircraft suffered serious damage. Philippines, Corregidor. Intermittent artillery duel and air bombardment. Visayans, no change. Mindanao, enemy operations on the Parang-Cotabato front continue. Details of a thrilling dogfight over Salamoa on Friday between an all-American fighter squadron and Japanese fighters, during which 4 Zeros were shot down into the sea or the jungle, have been supplied in a local paper. We spotted the Zeros, 7 in one bunch and 4 or 5 in another, the young leader of the squadron told a reporter. They were 4,000 feet above us, so I gave full throttle and turned for home. 2 of our fighters at the rear of the formation called out, "Let's have a go at them," and peeled off. Next thing, 12 Zeros were on 2 of our fighters. so we all turned back to join in. We chased each other from Ley to Salamoa and back, never getting above 1,000 feet. We fought almost down to the water in treetops. Three Zeros, which were definitely of a new type, were shot down in flames, and I didn't see any of the Japanese bail out. In addition to these three, we probably got another. For 25 minutes, it was the most terrific dogfight I have ever seen. I now return you to San Francisco.
Next, we hear the report by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. You know, the first families of America today are the first families that begin with A, B, C, D, and E that have to trek to the schoolhouses and register for sugar books. It's the most complete registration of names and addresses the country has known. There are plenty of questions about sugar ration, but the main thing to remember is that if you don't register, you get no book, no book, no sugar. If you lose your book, you can't get another for 2 months. Later on this month, you'll do about the same thing for gasoline. There's a rumor you may have to have a ration book for coffee, and the thing seems to be so attractive to your government officials at Washington that they may even ration bus rides and railroad transportation. You know, this is the thing that Great Britain has been undergoing for years, and so also some of our enemy countries and officials here call attention to the fact that rations are not, whether you might call it a hardship or not, Americans are still living the life of Riley in contrast to the rest of the unfortunate world. Germans have been standing in line for ration books and meagerly rationed rations for 7 years. German subsistence now is down to hard pan, and Great Britain is now on what we would call subnormal living, and rationed at that. Maybe the Americans cannot take it, maybe they can, but there will be 5 million men in the army by the end of 1943, if I read the signs rightly. That means a certain proportion of married men, and that's something the officials here seem to have ducked in their plain statements. I relate to you now what one of the leaders, highest officials, highest generals in the army, told me in answer to the question, which I asked him for the benefit of this broadcast, how many married men will have to be selected for the army. Well, said the general, we have already deferred about 65% of the men registered. We will have to take of this 65%, we'll have to take about 20% of that 65% of that deferred list. That means selecting some of the men who have married, were married right close up to draft time. They'll take obvious cases of draft dodging. We may have to take other newly married men. We do not want to break up old established families. The fact that the government is going to give $40 or $50 to wives will certainly alleviate a lot of trouble and otherwise suffering. And remember that $40 or $50 to some families, married families, is a whole lot of cash when you think of the folks that get $40 or $50 cash over in the course of a year only. The Army wants to knock out the added security pay, by the way, to families from the Social Security Service. Sounds cruel, but the Army argument is that this extra pay is something no one can tell about, and that it puts the whole business into politics. Maybe so, and I'm not arguing, I'm merely reporting, your congressman is the man to send your kick. Maybe today you'll hear more about gasoline rationing, too, because oil boss Ickes appears before a congressional committee today to give them the latest information about the intake and the output of gas. And that's all from Washington at this time.
These have been reports by John McVane from London, Sidney Albright from Australia, Robert Magadoff from Moscow, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company. Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you the news of the world with direct shortwave reports from overseas. The Axis submarine campaign against Allied shipping in the Atlantic today marked down two more victories. A medium-sized British vessel has been sunk off Florida, and a Brazilian vessel was torpedoed by a U-boat and went swiftly down in the warmer seas off Trinidad. Hitler's stealthy sea prowlers have now accounted for 159 Allied ships in that one sea battle zone just since December 7th. So grave has that hidden danger to our vital ships become that our British allies are now giving their best efforts in an attempt to remedy that evil at its source. RAF bombers today, as on many days, beat hardest at the ports from which the Nazi submarines glide forth. Three U-boat base ports, Hamburg, Germany, Kristiansand, Norway, and Saint-Nazaire, France, have all been under the shattering mallet blows of British high explosives during the last 24 hours. And American shipyards completed and delivered 36 new ships in the month of April. And now a word from Charles Lyon.
It's just plain good sense to take care of yourself when you have a cold. And for prompt relief of that dull, ache-all-over, miserable feeling, you'll appreciate what Alka-Seltzer offers. Help as much as you can by getting more rest than usual. Dress comfortably, too. Stay out of chilling drafts and get your daily allotment of vitamins. And if your cold causes a sore throat, ease that raw, raspy feeling by gargling with Alka-Seltzer. Get Alka-Seltzer at any drugstore and use it when you have a cold. And now, the news of the world.
The Japanese in Burma tonight seem to be extending their utmost ounce of energy to win a decisive and all-out Burma victory. Though all but a few fragments of that populous colony is now firmly in the invaders' grip, the Japs seem to be giving just as much attention to the last few minutes of play on that Burma battlefield as they gave at the beginning. The Japs have already won the race against time and have accomplished the conquest of most of central Burma before the coming of the monsoon rains. But today, still in high gear, Jap infantrymen are slogging as fast as they can push up the Burmese section of the Burma Road to win to the very gates of China. The enemy's progress through that part of the Burma highway, which twists only moderately through hills of between 1,000 and 2,000 feet, has been very rapid. Successive nests of Chinese resistance along that narrow way have been briskly attacked, and it is plainly the Japs' intention to hunt out and to exterminate every such surviving pocket of enemy troops, then to advance along the Burma Road as far as they are able, and there, in the steep mountain and ravine country, which is not far off, close that Burma Road so decisively that no more Chinese troops can get down it, and get down it to join the Burma battle and harass the Jap winners when the time comes for them to turn their attention elsewhere. On Luzon, the Japs had quite enough experience of the cost of leaving unbeaten enemy nests surviving on their flanks. So in Burma, they do not seem to want to repeat that mistake again. Today's news shows that the final cleanup job for which the enemy is aiming may well be a long one. British planes today based in India bombed with destructive force a concentration of Jap invasion barges on a Burma river, and U.S. Air Corps flyers have again attacked the vital Japanese supply port of Rangoon. Though both the Chinese and the British armies are now in retreat, they are withdrawn in opposite directions, so the Japs must divide, and the defenders still have fight left in them. And as the Japanese move almost hourly closer to the Indian frontier, we turn to our reporter who speaks direct from New Delhi.
This is Francis Muir speaking from Delhi. I have just had an hour's exclusive interview with Mr. Rodrigo Pellizzari, the dynamic man from Madras who, after years of association, has had the courage to break with the most powerful politicians in India, the Congress leaders. He is the exponent of cooperation with the Muslim League in the interests of India's safety. He believes that immediate, constructive collaboration between Hindus and Muslims could and should be worked out, and that the ultimate solution of their problems is entirely practical, but that the war must be one source, and that only in unity lies strength. By assuring the Muslims now of a fair deal from the Hindus, even their coveted separate status, if they still insist on it after the war, he feels that unity can be achieved. Coercion of a minority by the majority is suicidal, he says. The most remarkable characteristic of this Indian is his emphasis not on the ideal, but on the practical. He told me, and I quote, "I have done what a conscientious individual must do when he finds that almost all his colleagues in the most important political organization of the country have failed to see the realities of a situation which is fraught with gravest danger. In resigning as a member of their working committee, I have given a shock to my colleagues, hoping that the shock will make them think. Nehru and I both reject the policy of facility. We hotly desire to defend India against the draft. We both want to tap the manpower of India, and in the meantime, we both want to use all the resources which America and Britain can give us. We both trust America. But Nehru is so angry with Britain now that he has tied himself up to a negative policy. I am equally angry with Britain, but I know mere anger serves no purpose now. We must face the situation that has developed. And here my colleagues have refused to go along with me. I must appeal to the people. My job is to convert people to a realistic view. I think, he continued, that if America takes the initiative, Nehru could be helped out of his negative entanglement. And now, goodbye from Delhi.
Now that was India relayed to us via London. And now we switch controls to San Francisco for a report direct from Australia.
This is Marvin Abramsky calling from Allied headquarters in Australia. While the major Jap activity in the Australian area so far has developed from Ley and Salamo in New Guinea and from Rabaul in New Britain, it's a good idea not to wear blinkers in watching the Jap moves in the Southwest Pacific. The Japs already have a northern base in the Solomon Islands at Bougainville. A Jap move in the Solomon Islands, say against the Tulagi, the Allied base in the most southerly of the Solomon group, would seem to fit perfectly into a Jap plan to move south step by step toward the Pacific Island bases, which guard the United Nations supply line with the United States. The Solomons lie northwest of the New Hebrides and the Fiji Islands. If the Japs follow the stepping stone technique, to which they faithfully stuck in every Far Eastern campaign in the past, Tulagi and the Solomons would be their first objective in moving southward. An attack on the New Hebrides and the Fiji Islands would equally seem to be the next logical step. And after these moves, they would be face to face with New Caledonia. Equally, in watching the fierce aerial activity in the New Guinea area, it's easy to forget the Philippines. Tokyo Radio yesterday claimed that Japs have made two fresh landings on the northwest coast of Mindanao, most southerly of the Philippine Island group. No official confirmation is available here yet, but this may be true. If it is accurate, it's again in line with the Japs' policy of firmly consolidating their southerly advance in the Pacific. More important, it might make our own offensive task infinitely more difficult if the Japs succeed in establishing and consolidating a strong bridgehead in Mindanao. To conduct an offensive from Australia against the Japs, the United Nations, too, would have to use the stepping stone technique. Mindanao would, by pure geographic necessity, seem to be one of the most important of our offensive stepping stones. In developing the long-range view, there remains only one more factor, naval activity. For fear of revealing information of value to the enemy, correspondents here have refrained from speculating on possible Jap naval concentrations in this area. We are informed by American newspapers, however, that such concentrations exist. If the papers at home are right, the armchair strategists might find this comment in a Sydney Sun editorial yesterday useful for further speculation. The Sun writes, I quote, "Thus far, Allied air forces have kept the Japs at arm's length from eastern Australia. Naval intervention, however, must become imperative."
That was Martin Agronsky speaking from Australia. This is San Francisco, and from the city by the Golden Gate to our nation's capital, we switch to Earl Godwin in Washington.
Good evening, folks. The first families are all sugar booking today, first families in an alphabetical sense, as America lines up for the first time in a complete subjugation to the planned economy of total war. The planned economy of the New Deal appears mild in contrast as day by day the American population bows before this war juggernaut. As we all become common ordinary supplicants for sugar on an 8-ounce-per-week basis, the war machine head, Don Nelson's WPB, takes all the iron so that nothing but war stuff can be made from iron and steel, and tells us if there's anything we want to make out of metal, well, it's okay with the WPB if we use gold or silver, and that's true. Is there anything that indicates the upside-down era better than the fact that gold is useless and that to all America the rare precious metals are iron and steel? Restraints are in sight, too, for all rubber tire transportation as the President adds to the authority already imposed upon Joe Eastman, Defense Transportation Director, power over, quote, all rubber-borne transportation facilities including passenger cars, buses, taxicabs, and trucks, and to develop programs to facilitate the continuous adjustment of the nation to the available supply of transportation services rely upon rubber, unquote, and so forth. Here's the man and the power which may up and say to you, brother, give me that car, your Uncle Sam needs it. And you may hear some definite news tomorrow about gas and oil rations. Oil boss Ickes, who has the most complete knowledge of the subject, may recommend something on this matter tomorrow. One thing which causes most of this squeezing down on supplies is the lack of ships. The Maritime Commission answers that today with the news it has delivered into ocean-going service more than one ship a day in April. 36 ships, not merely launched, but ready to steam off. 206 ships in service in the first 4 months, while 200 keels were laid. And if Hitler has been hinting peace, he certainly got the cold shoulder here from soft-spoken but red-hot Cordell Hull, who says flat rejection awaits any offer from Hitler, while the President told the Minister of Iraq today, the war can end only with a complete victory for the United Nations, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Many experts on nutrition agree that millions of Americans have hidden hunger because they do not get an adequate supply of vitamins in their daily diet. How about you? How have you been feeling lately? Is your appetite good? Do you tire easily? Do you sleep well? Do you feel as alive and alert as you should these spring days? Are you getting your daily supply of vitamins, especially the B vitamins? If you're not, maybe you should. Today, in war times, we're all working harder, tiring out oftener, taxing nerves and digestion, and using up energy as never before. These are the reasons why most of us should be sure we are not lacking in B vitamins. And here is a new and improved way to get your B complex vitamins. It's the one-a-day way. One tablet a day is all you take. One tablet a day is all you pay for. Compare one-a-day brand B complex vitamin tablets with the old-fashioned kind where you take 3 or 4 capsules or tablets a day. Then you'll soon see how economical, how convenient they are. Remember, each one-a-day B-complex tablet supplies the average person his basic daily requirements of those B vitamins whose requirements have been established. Start taking them now and take them every day for just a couple of weeks and see what they do for you. Not 4, not 3, not 2, but only one tablet a day is all you take. That's why they cost you only about 25 cents a week to use. And after you try them, we believe you'll say it's the best 25 cents you ever spent. Ask your druggist for one-a-day brand B-complex vitamin tablets. He has them in 3 sizes, but insist on one-a-day brand if you want to save money. Look for the big one on the package. Now, this is Charles Lyon saying goodbye until this same time tomorrow evening. This is the National Broadcasting Company.